be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
This is Richie Wexler. Welcome to Vintage Annals Archive, episode 60, The Black Virgin. Black Virgin is a completely improvised show that started at the Groundlings Theater in L.A. in 2010 to sold-out crowds and great reviews. The all-African-American cast of regulars included the show creator Jordan Black, who we'll be talking to today, along with other veterans Cedric Yarbrough, Gary Anthony Williams, Danielle Gowther, Phil Lamar, and Naima Funk, all under the direction of Karen Moriyama, who will be also speaking to today. We're hoping to have other guests on sooner. The strike kind of threw us off a little bit. Special guests of that show have included Kiki Michael Key, Jordan Peele, Wayne Brady, Maya Rudolph, Tiffany Haddish, Niecy Nash, Jerry Minor, Angela V. Shelton, Misty Monroe, and many others to come. Jordan Black is a former writer for SNL, Saturday Night Live, The Last OG, and a former writer-producer for The Last Man Standing and the reboot of Punky Brewster. He's currently a writer-producer on the reboot of The Wonder Years on ABC, which is an amazing show. We're also speaking to Karen Moriyama, who not only enjoys acting but improvising, but also teaches class all levels, as having the privilege of directing main shows. She is the director of this show. She does Sunday shows, something called Gas Shows, and The Black Virgin, which is the one we're talking about today. She's currently part of the directing facility at the American Film Institute. Very cool person. Both very cool people. Had a great chat with both of them, and hoping to get some more folks in for the second part. But we wanted to release this while we could. So anyway, thank you and enjoy.
Hi.
Hey, Jordan, how's it going? So I guess I want to know kind of how this started for you. I don't know if this is a kind of a silly question, but is the Black Virgin from your name or just the story thing? I mean,
that's a great question, actually, Rich. No, rarely do people ask. Like every month when we do the show, our director kind of explains that to the audience, or she used to. I don't know. She used to, because we do a different opening now.
Yeah.
She's also say like the namesake of our show, Jordan Black. But I think most people don't remotely get that, because it's not like I'm super famous, so people go like, well, of course, if it was Jamie Foxx and it's like, you know, crazy as like a fox, people go, oh, because that's his name, you know. People don't always put it together, because it also is the premise of our show. So, but yes, the idea for the title came from my name. I was like, what if I did something that was my show and it called The Black Virgin, because that's a thing. But I didn't have a show yet.
Right.
Just an idea of a title of something.
Because you were because you were the one who answered the email, I assumed you had a more of a stake, because you were the one handling,
yeah,
you know, the press. So, you know, it was a little, I was maybe a bit of a cheat there, but.
Well, yeah, I created the show. And yeah, so the title came, I had the title before I had a show, because it was just like, I have a list of zillions of titles that I go like, this is a good title to something someday. You know, that was one of them. And so I actually did these, like in the early 2000s, I did these shorts, YouTube videos with a bunch of the same people that are in the cast now, before we did a live show, but they were scripted. It was like the Black Virgin. It was like iconic scenes from movies, and we shot and filmed like the Black versions of them. And so that was the first time I used that title, and that was it. We did those, and that was sort of the end of it for years. And then at a certain point, I wanted to do an improv show with all my funny Black improv friends, and I couldn't figure out what the show would be. And I thought, like, well, what if we do like long form, and we do like maybe we'll take a movie title and we'll just do the long form, our version of, like, since we're all Black, we'll do the Black version of that movie. I was like, oh, that sounds funny to me, just sitting here thinking about it. I said, and we'll just call it the Black version. Perfect title. Good. Easy.
I know that from what I've heard about it is like the first section is like more of this, you know, more of the plot of this, you know, the scene within the improv within the idea. And then it seems like the next part is, you know, more like behind the scenes, things that are like tangential. So is that like, my limited knowledge of improv, is that kind of a form of a Harold in some sense?
I would say, as someone who's never done a Harold, but I would say Harold.
They're horrible. They're really hard.
No comment. I don't have an attitude one way or the other, but I just never done one or seen one, but because Groundlings don't teach the Herald style.
Oh,
but,
really? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they don't teach Herald. That's I know a lot of other places do, but we just the Groundlings never taught, and that's the only place I ever studied. And so, but I think Herald is like the father of long form. And yeah. So, but yeah, it is based on like. There's short form improv and there's long form improv. I'm gonna stop banging on this pot.
That's okay. It's all right.
Sorry, I'm making breakfast, listeners.
No, this is a new approach.
It's okay. I'm gonna give you some recipes too.
I'm gonna trim my nails while we're doing. We're just so we're both on the same page, both doing some chores. I'm just teasing you. I'm sorry. It's all good.
I'm just gonna answer your question about the style. Like, so yeah, I would say yes. The short answer is yes. It's similar to Herald in that we're not getting. Suggestions for brand new scenes throughout. It's one story that we kind of take in whatever direction we kind of see fit. Even though ours is sort of baked in because we have a sort of an outline based on whatever the movie is we're doing. As a loose structure.
Yeah, getting back to the Groundlings, I don't know much about the structure of the Groundlings. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious on what your experiences were. Again, like if there's any story that comes to mind of your training there, of like I don't need you to give me a 10-point thing, but just I'm just curious on why you landed at the Groundlings, what was it like for you to train there?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, like, story-wise, like, my attitude, I had been doing improv since I was 12.
Wow.
And,
oh, wow.
And so, not that anybody was watching, it was like in school, like drama class, we did improv. I absolutely loved it, fell in love. It was like, It immediately was like I knew what I wanted to do with the rest of my life when I did improv. Nice. Even though I didn't know improv was something that you could do for an audience. And we just did it as an exercise in class.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've been doing improv forever. So by the time I came to LA and I started getting into some improv and sketch groups, the problem was we couldn't get anybody to come to our shows, because it's improv and sketch. Nobody wants to see that. I didn't know that until much later.
I mean, some people do, but
not enough. Definitely not enough. Which is understandable because most of it is terrible, and the shows I was in were terrible. But I knew of the Groundlings, and I knew that the Groundlings was like this sort of like it was the place to be seen and get discovered. But my problem with it was to be in the Groundlings, you had to take their classes and pay the money, and I was like. I'm past classes. Like, I'm an improv genius. I'm not going to pay for classes. So what happened, I was doing all these shows with my homie and my friends, and I was like, Lorne Michaels is not going to come see these shows, clearly.
Right, right.
So I guess I'll have to go to where he will come. And so I guess my attitude was like, I'll bite the bullet. I'll go and do their little classes, even though it's a waste of my time. And then as soon as I started the classes, I was like, oh, my God. Everybody in this class, and this is the basic level, day one, like some of the worst improvisers probably in the world are in this class, and most of them are better than the people I've been performing with all these years. So I was like, oh, all the people who are good at improv don't waste their time, they come to the Groundlings. So I was like, oh, this is, and then I learned so much. It was like, I totally needed this.
I did a little improv, and what I found was hard is that you're thrown into a class with people that you might not have any similar sense of humor.
Yeah.
So you don't know how to work on. I mean, you would find your people probably, but you don't. Yeah. It seems like a hard challenge to do it. But go back.
I think you make a good point, Rich. Yes, that's very true. And that's like I've also taught at Groundlings, and that's one of the things I tell my students. Like sometimes you'll give a student notes, and they go like, "Yeah, but I was up there with so and so, and they made this." And I go, "No, no. A good improviser." Makes a bad improviser look like a good improviser.
Yeah.
Period. That's your job. You don't get to come off stage and the scene tanked and you say it was because of my scene partner.
Right.
You're depending on each other. If the scene isn't going anywhere, a good improviser has tools to know how to dig you out of the problem, which is what we're teaching. So, yeah, when you first get in there, yeah, you have no control over who you're going to be up with. You don't have chemistry with these people.
Yeah.
But over time, you develop that. Within a class, you do develop that.
And are you still, I mean, I'm assuming it's still basic improv, like yes, ending and that kind of such, right?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's the good thing about like, one of the knocks I get from people on Groundlings, they'll say, oh, the Groundlings has all these rules. It's too many rules. And I go, yes, there's a lot of rules when you're a student and you're studying.
Right, right.
I said, but you'll go see a Groundlings show and you'll watch the Groundlings on stage. Because sometimes students will say that, I saw a show and they were breaking some of the rules. And I would always say this. Right, because they're masters. Right. You cannot break the rules until you master the rules.
Right.
We know how, like, when you get to a certain level of improv, you're not up there thinking about the rules at all. The rules are, you're done with that.
Yeah.
But it's so, like, ingrained in you that the rules only exist for when you get in trouble in a scene, you know, oh, I can do this, I can do that. I got some options in my toolkit that can help dig us out of this scene. And that's it.
I want to get back to you talking about teaching, because you said something in one of the articles I read that, and I was being careful about how I phrase this, because it's something you said about that you had black students were getting on stage and don't want to get on stage and be black. And I took that as more as act black, because I think it has different implications for being black.
Right.
Anyway, and as a white person, I'm just trying to clarify that.
I'll dig you out of it, Rich.
I'm Jewish, so I'm not all white. So I got a little break. So I'm curious on, like, that, you know, how working with black students, how improv, in my opinion, has not been super inclusive of, you know, I mean, you were in the early days, you worked with Key and Peele. Those guys are known for talking about race through comedy. I'm just curious on if that was your end at all, and, you know, how that built into the show also, and how that built into your teaching, if you can. And I'll let you talk on that for as long as you want to.
Yeah, well, I'll say definitely it's still a very white art form.
Yeah.
And I saw that, you know, I grew up in America. I grew up in a small town, Midwest, so I was used to being, you know.
Where did you grow up?
Small town called Kankakee, Illinois.
Okay.
So, and when I was a kid, it was a mostly white town. And I was just used to being around a lot of white people. I'm also used to being around a lot of black people too, because my town got blacker as the years went on. But I was used to that. So initially going into it, it's not like I was going like, there's no black people here, because I was used to being the only black in situation. Me personally, because of my personality and my politics and all of that, I saw it as an opportunity, like, nobody's gonna be doing the characters I can do, so that's how I'm gonna stand out. I'm gonna do all these, like, you can call them stereotypically black characters, not offensively stereotypical, but just, I mean, from my experience.
Right.
And so I did that, and it did it. People loved it. If they found it funny, it made me stand out. So all the things I wanted it to do. And that's to this day, that's my approach. Even though when I do the black version, that's still my approach, even though I'm not the only black person on stage. But now it's just what I do. But with students, what I saw with a lot of students at Groundlings, and I've had these conversations with students, is they won't pull out any black characters. Meaning, like, all their characters are in the same vein as everybody else in the class.
Okay.
You know, kind of like generic, like, and not that other people are doing generic characters, they're doing the characters from their life. But then the black person is also kind of doing characters like their characters. And I would say to them, I understand what you're doing. You are saying, like, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I don't want to be stereotyped. I don't want them to think that black is the only thing I am. I get that. Hey, you already lost that battle. You walked in black, they think you're black. So there's that. But the main thing I try to tell them, especially at the Groundlings, because the Groundlings is a very competitive program. Like, you're trying to get into the main company, and it's almost impossible.
Oh, shit.
And
okay.
I said, everybody in this classroom is using every single tool in their toolbox to get through this program. And you're going to take like 80% of your toolbox and say, I'm not going to use that. I'm going to use this other part of the toolbox, which isn't really my culture, but I don't want them to think that I'm only my culture. I want them to know that I know their culture too. And it's like, okay, good luck with that. You know,
it's hard to pull off a Chad or an Ashley if you're a person of color.
You got to be playing. They're playing their uncles and their aunts and their grandparents. Right. And their parents. You got to play the same. And you,
yeah.
I don't know how, what culture you grew up in. Like, if you're black, but you grew up mostly in a white culture, like I did, you still got some relatives that's from them streets, that's from the South, whatever it is, that are they're characters.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that person is a character. I need to put them on stage. But you're like, I don't want to do it because that's a very black character. And I don't want them to think that that's all I can do. Audiences respond the best to the truth.
Yeah.
When you hit, it's like comedians about, you know, it's funny because it's true. That statement is a true fact.
Yeah.
Like, if audience goes, I relate to that, I've seen that, I've been that, I've had that, I've got, that's my aunt, that's my uncle, that's my mom, that's me. If you're trying to play a character that's not based on anything reality other than just like you sort of Frankensteining these ideas together, it might be funny. It might even be really funny, but it's going to be a lot harder.
I want to dig a little more into some of the shows, and I just, you know, I there's not a ton of information out there about the show, so I want to fix that to a certain sense. Yeah. I'm curious on, It seems, you know, from just like learning about the holiday special, it seems like there's a lot of musical theater. I got mm-hmm. to interview Cedric, mm-hmm. who is one of the nicest people I've ever yeah. talked to. And I know he's got some musical theater. I know like some other people. Yeah. So I'm curious on you or the troupe, like where is, you know, what's the musical theater background there?
Oh, I have no musical theater background nor okay. any musical ability. Now don't get me wrong. I sing in the show. I rap right. in the show.
Nice.
I don't think anybody's buying a ticket to see me sing and rap, but they're going to see it anyway, cause it's part of the show. I think I'm enough of an actor that I'm passable, you know, but we also have some real ringers in there, like Cedric, Gary Anthony Williams, Daniel Gaither, Naima Funk. Like they can sing, rap, dance. Well, they're the full entertainment package. And then Phil Lamar and I are less musical. So we kind of do sort of more of the, we're going to do some funny characters mostly. But we all have to do the singing. We all have to do the rapping. And we do, and it's a lot of fun. But it really just comes from our improv background, meaning musical improv is a big part of improv, particularly at the Groundlings anyway. So when I was creating the show, I was like, well, we should have some, I wasn't thinking like, oh, some of these people are really good. I was just like, we should have some music in it and do some songs, because movies have theme songs and things like that. It's just another thing to add to the experience of, this is a movie. Now all our shows are pretty much musicals. Like, they're not operas, so we're not singing all the dialogue, but we have dialogue scene, we have a song, and, you know. So we have several songs interspersed throughout the show, and we have an incredible band.
I'm glad I got to you, because I've been trying to get to Gary to interview him. Right around the time I talked to Cedric, I was like, I was such a fan of Gary from Malcolm in the Middle and others, yeah. and just seeing him around, and I was just like, holy shit. I guess what brings me back to, what's like the origin story of the troupe? How do you find these, you know, how do you get together?
I'll tell you, like I said, like most of the time when I was in improv groups, I was the only Black.
Right.
Maybe once in a while there might be one other. Very rarely. Same at the Groundlings. You know, I go to classes, be the only Black. So once I got into the company and I'm doing shows and all that, and I start working a little more and, you know, in television, I would meet a Black person who, like at the Groundlings, like we have this show, The Groundlings, every Thursday called The Gas Show. It's just a short form improv show. It's been around for like 30 years. And it was like my favorite show to do for so long, just loved doing it. And every blue moon, when I'd show up, there'd be one other Black person there, like a guest. Like, and it would be like Jordan Peele or Keegan or Cedric, right? And I'd be like, oh, there's another Black person tonight? Oh, it's about to be, bruh, you know we about to tear this up tonight, right? You know, like, you get so excited, you know? That's how I met them, like, you know, so just seeing them in the room made me go, like, I didn't really know their work outside. You know, I knew of them, but I didn't really know their shows and stuff. Like, I wasn't like a regular viewer. So, but I just knew, like, if you're here, you're probably a halfway decent improviser. There's two Black people here tonight. We're going to get to have some fun. So that was really, and I was going to say, it's like, it's probably similar to, like, female improvisers in the early days, like, there's another woman here? Oh, we're gonna, you know what I mean? So, and I always had this idea that I wanted to do an all Black improv show, but I just didn't have enough Black improvisers that I knew.
Right, right, right.
And so then as the years went by, like, I met Gary Anthony Williams on a movie set, and then asked him to come and do an improv show at the Groundlings, and found out he was an insanely talented improviser. Like,
holy shit.
It was crazy. Like, I met him, I told the Groundlings about him, and then he's been doing shows there, like, every week for like a million years.
So yeah.
Like, oh, I want him in the show. He's probably done more shows at the Groundlings than some Groundlings, and definitely more shows in the Groundlings than like a lot of alum ever did. So, but anyway, so I met him. Daniel Gaither I met at the Groundlings.
Okay.
And then, so what happened was, one day after many years of like meeting different people, I started doing the math. I was like, I think that's like seven people. That's enough for an improv show. And that's how. And so then I reached out to everybody just to ask them if they wanted to do a show. And everybody was like, yes. Yeah. So the original show was me, Keegan-Michael Key, Jordan Peele, Gary Anthony Williams, Cedric Yarbrough, Daniel Gaither, and Phil Lamar. So that's who did it.
Fucking dream team there. I don't know Danielle that much, but that's a dream team.
Yeah, it was dream. It was, and it was the first. So that was our cast for the first couple of years until, because Key and Peele wasn't on the air yet. They hadn't even, that show wasn't even created yet. So once they created that show and went off, then Keegan introduced me to Naima Funk, because they came from, they both are from Detroit, and they knew each other in Detroit, doing Second City in Detroit, and then we're friends here in LA, and he told me about her and told me how great she was. So, and I was like, yeah, yeah, whatever. And then she came, did the show, and I was like, oh my God, you have to come and be a regular member of the cast.
I'm curious how you prepare and how you practice. I'm also curious on how Karen directs you guys.
Okay.
Because it seems like, from something I read, it seems like sometimes that's in real time, and maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, it is real time. What happens is, the way the Black Virgin show works for our director, and Karen is like my favorite director. She's directed all my, like, what I call my independent shows, the ground shows. Nice. I made it. But she's the best, because she's very sharp. She knows her stuff. She's got a lot of experience. But she's also the meanest. And I like that, because you get, I come from a single mom of four boys, so I only know how to respond to tough love. So she gives you a lot of tough love. She gives you real notes, whether you like it or not. And I like that, because it'll make me better. So I always pick her as my director. And so, but so with our show, if we get the movie title, Karen comes out, introduces us to the audience, the whole thing. She gets the title, and the audience votes on it, and then she picks. And then she basically directs the movie. So she'll say, let's say if it's Titanic, she'll say, okay, well, let's go to the first scene where he, in the movie, Leonardo DiCaprio's gambling in the bottom of the ship for the tickets, whatever. Well, and then she'll ask, but what's our version? Instead of gambling, what are they doing? Or whatever it is, and we'll do our Black version of that scene. And then she'll move, then that scene will end at some point, she'll call it. And then she'll say, okay, next scene, he meets the Kate Winslet character. And okay, in the movie, they might have met like this, but what's our, what audience, what's your idea for how they meet on this boat? And the audience will give a suggestion, and then we'll just run off with that and do whatever we want. Now, I was gonna say, she keeps the story moving and picks out those iconic moments in the movie for us to do our version of.
So is she performative in this way, or is she huddling with you guys?
She's not on stage with us. She's like almost like a narrator type character. So the scene stops, and then she talks to the audience about, here's where we're going next, or where do you wanna go next? Like, we keep it very open. So the audience is still a part of making suggestions.
How do you all prepare and practice for this kind of a thing?
We don't rehearse.
We don't.
Well, we don't, because we're all like, hey, it's improv, so you can't really, because you don't know what you're gonna get. And as far as like, I mean, individually, we can all go and take an improv class as a tune-up if we wanted to. I don't know that most of us do that anymore, because you know, the show is a tune-up. You're constantly being tuned up. But also at the same time, it is also always nice. Like when I would teach, I haven't taught in a long time, but when I would teach, teaching was a tune-up. I go like, oh yeah, that's right. I got to remember that the next time I'm doing a show. Like these different improv rules and things that are just helpful. But what we do before every show is we work with the band, like we run through the music. Just so that, because it's really a sound check. So, and make sure the band remembers the songs, and that even though the songs are improvised, we have different styles that we do, and we have different like we might do a parody of a real song, so we'll run through it, make sure the band knows those songs, and make sure that the sound, but that's it, that's our warm-up, is we just run through the music numbers.
Are you using pre-made songs and just parodying them, or are you using any kind of structure to build songs?
Both. I know it was,
okay,
we do both. We have different songs we do parodies of. Like Shallow, when that song came out, we came up with, you know, we added that, meaning like whatever our movie's about, whatever those two characters are doing, we get a song title and they sing it in the style of Shallow. So it's different lyrics, of course, they're making up the lyrics, but it's that song, that recognizable tune and melody. And then we also have numbers where it's just like, what's the style? Oh, it's reggae. Oh, it's disco. Okay, they're going to do this style of disco. And the band just plays a generic sort of disco melody.
What are your, well, I guess the preface is, what are your audiences like in general? Like makeup, is it mixed? Is it?
It's mostly white, because that's the Groundlings audience. But I'll say for our show over the years, the number of Black people we get is a lot compared to every other show with the Groundlings. Like we get a lot, and you know, I don't know exactly. I would say it's still majority white. I would say maybe it's 10 to 15% of the audience is Black, which is still a lot for us. It's great, you know, because Black audiences really love the show. Like, because there's a certain pride I can tell they take from seeing the show, from seeing that much talent on stage doing something that unexpected, because a lot of, you know, a lot of Black audiences don't know improv shows because we don't go, because we never see any Black people in them. So when they come to something like this, usually it's because they just heard from somebody, you guys see the show, it's this Black version movie, they like, you guys see, and people come and see it, and then they're like, their minds are blown, because A, they've never seen improv, B, they've never seen improv at this level, like, it's good. And you know, and they recognize some of the faces, and it's exciting, and then the music is great, so it's a real production. So I think all of that, and then they, and you can tell that they just take a lot of pride, because when we performed in other cities like DC and places like that, like in DC particularly, where we have, I would say, a majority Black audience come out and see us, it's just, it's bananas. Like, it's, the love is just so infectious, and it's just so palpable. So we love that. We wish we could get more to come out.
So I guess a question based on that, I had a question written down, like, have you all ever thought about like a series, thought about like a film based on the work you're doing? I don't know if there's stuff you can and can't talk about, but I'm just curious on, have you tried, you know, in terms of Black audiences, have you tried to create something that's meant for a Black audience? And, you know,
and I'm not saying this in any sort of negative way. The kind of projects I think of, because I'm also a writer, I never think about, oh, this is for a Black audience. Like, Black version, I didn't think of as for a Black audience. Anything, like even creating like a TV show or movie around it, I don't, it just, that's not the way my mind works. That's the way marketers think. That's not the way most artists think. They just go, I have an idea and I like it and I think everybody should see it. And I would say to the first part of that question, yes, we've developed the show for TV. We've developed it for features. Like, we've been doing the show 13 years and we pretty much have been under a development deal of one sort or another the entire time. Nobody's ever pulled the trigger and actually ordered a series or greenlit a movie. And that's, you know, that's just the industry. And I know that it's because everybody's Black. And most of the people who we're pitching to are not Black. Because again, in the improv world, so that's who knows about us. Like, it's the, you know, the more mainstream buyers are who are aware of us, and they get nervous. They're just like, who's this for? Like, even though they can come to the show and see a sea of white faces, in their mind, they still go like, yeah, but only Black people will watch this. And they, you know, the unfortunate truth of Hollywood is they're not interested in Black audiences.
You know? And it's a shame. And I didn't mean to imply that you had to do that. It just seems like with the lack of representation, it's needed. I'm not saying you have to be the one who does it.
Right. No, of course. And I knew you weren't saying it in that way. I just wanted to clarify. Part of the problem with our show, and again, this speaks to America, it speaks to the industry. The problem is our show isn't stereotypically Black. We're not up here acting like, yo, son, come on, this is right. This ain't your mom. We're not doing that. We're working at the top of our intelligence, and that's just because of who we are. I'm not even knocking the other thing. I have no problem with that style of comedy at all. It's just the people, me and the people I are in my show, that's not our background, and that's not where we attack comedy from. I think that's another reason Black people love it so much, because it is different. And that's part of the problem with the buyers in this industry, is they go like, if we were more of that, I think we would have gotten on air sooner, because they're like, I know who the audience is for this. But with our show, they don't know who the audience is, because they think that the everyday Black person won't relate to us because we're not doing that hood street comedy. And they think white people won't relate to us because we're Black. So they're like, so who's the show for? You know? So that's fine.
It's a shame because I feel like the same thing, you know, I mean, Key and Peele got very lucky and they're extremely fucking talented and hardworking, but that show like transcended all that shit.
I would say that's a perfect example, Rich. Key and Peele, like when they got that show, before it ever came on the air, I said, I don't know if the show will be a hit. I don't know if anybody will watch or care. I said, but I know it's going to be good because I know them and I know how smart they are. And when you put funny with smart, it's going to be bananas. Again, that doesn't mean people are going to watch. So when people actually watched and it was a hit, I couldn't believe that blew my mind. That's what surprised me. It's like, oh my God, somebody's doing a good show about Black culture and people are actually watching. Like, and I think our show is sort of in that same vein.
Yeah.
And they say, but still, it's a hard sell. It's a really
I think the reason I wanted to talk to you and also, I mean, again, after me talking with Shedrick, I just like, I didn't really know much about the Black version. I was like, holy shit, why is this thing not bigger? Why don't I know about it? Like, this is amazing. I mean, Key and Peele was made for a mixed audience, which is great. I mean, everything should be to a certain extent, but having a certain amount of Black content to me is important as well for representation and for connecting with, to letting other Black actors know, hey, you could do this too.
Yeah.
Again, not that that's your thing,
right,
or role.
Well, I would say, Rich, like when you say it's made for a mixed audience, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. They literally just made the show they wanted to make. There was no, they didn't put any, and I'm just saying this based on knowing them personally and the way their minds work and having watched the show. And so, yeah, that's their sense of humor already. That was their sense of humor from day one. All of those sketches are just them. That's who they are. But you're right. You're right that it is for a mixed audience, because guess what? All comedy is for a mixed audience.
Right. I think what I meant more is it's meant to reach everybody.
It is. Yeah. But I know what you mean. What you're saying is like, it wasn't marketed as, oh, this is for the Black, this is for the BET audiences. They didn't go that route. They just went through, because that's not who they are. They would have never, like, nobody would ever put them on a BET, and I'm not casting spurs on BET. Love BET, I love the comedy they do. But there's different homes for different styles of comedy. Most time, Comedy Central types still won't buy it. You go like, oh, I'm Black, but my comedy style is this. They go, yeah, but you're Black, so we don't do Black comedy.
But I mean, for the strength of that show is they do white characters and all kinds of characters. And, right, you know, and I think what's really, which seems like tied to what you're doing and what they're doing, obviously, because coming up together, it's like they teach about race through humor. And I think that's the best way to really talk about this kind of stuff. I want to get into like the, I'm curious about suggestions. I'm curious about certain shows. What are some of the whitest, if you can, I want to hear about the show or maybe a story. What are some of the whitest as fuck suggestions you've had to pull off?
Suggestions can be, in our show, suggestions can be problematic at times. And we try to very gently and lovingly and with humor educate our white audiences when we feel like you getting a little too comfortable in this dialogue. Because there's sometimes, especially if Black people are in the audience, you can feel the Black people like cringe or groan. Our audience, like, because we've been doing the show so long, we have a lot of repeat audiences. Now a lot of our Black people will just say something. But again, lovingly, they'll just say like, no, no. And they'll yell something else out. Like, no, like, so I'll give you an example we get in every show almost. Like especially if it's let's say if you say, oh, give this character a name. In the movie, this character's name was John. But what is their name here? They'll go Tyrone, or they'll say Raquan.
Yeah,
what's her name? Latiqua. And sometimes our director will take it because she's just trying to move through the show. And sometimes she'll be like, anything else? Or we'll be on stage and we'll go like, who said that?
You know, get out.
Was that a white person? If that was a white person, if a Black person said it, we'll take it. You know, so like we make a joke out of it, but at the same time, they're learning like, maybe I should yell out stereotypes to this audience.
And I'm really glad you gave that background. For me, I'm what I was asking, and I'm really happy you gave that. I'm just more like, what would, like, you know, I don't know. When I think about it, it's like, you know, 16 can, like, I think it's some of the whitest shit.
Oh,
and
the
I'm just
movie
wondering. Guys. Yeah, wondering, like, what, you know, like, what were some of the, like, how the fuck, you know, how am I going to fucking do the Brady Bunch? You know what I mean? That kind of
right,
shit.
Well,
like, what's some of the, like, pure white bread crap that you've done well and you've pulled off?
Well, I mean, that is the premise of a show. We want the whitest, corniest version of a movie you can think of. Because then it gives us more to play with.
So tell me about some of those. If you don't mind, I just want to hear about...
We've been doing the show 13 years. We've done them all. Like, we've done all the John Hughes movies.
Okay.
You know?
All right.
You know, all 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, St. Elmo's Fire. Well, that's not John Hughes, but that's the...
It's the same. It might as well be.
That's the Brat Pack.
Yeah.
You know, Home Alone. You know, but like, what people really love for us to do, because it feels the whitest, is when they yell out a cartoon like Finding Nemo or something, like, because we'll do those.
So I want you to walk, if you're okay, I want you to walk me through how that show was, what kind of stuff you did, if there were songs. I want to hear, like, I want to, you know, get an eyewitness's view on some of the nitty gritty, if you're okay with
it. Well, I mean, it's hard for me to remember because I've been, like, okay. I said, it's just a line, they all blur together now, but
yeah.
Let me think, like, I'll give you an example, like we did years ago, we did Back to the Future, right?
Okay.
And one thing that stands out to me that I remember that just was so funny and so mind-blowing to me, and this, again, this Keegan and Jordan were on the show. This was before Key and Peele was on TV.
Right.
So there's an added funniness to this once you know that show. But at the end, when they come back, at the end of Back to the Future, when he comes home and everything's now fixed, and everything's better for his parents. Like, Keegan had played the Crispin Glover character, the nerdy dad who gets bullied, right?
Right.
But in the end, he's a winner because he changed the history, so now his dad. So Keegan comes out, and he's a Barack Obama in the future. And it was so, like, it just, like, I'm, you know, I stand on stage laughing the whole time anyway, because that's just me. So yeah. I just die laughing, because I'm just like, that's so smart and brilliant. Like, yeah, in the past, I was this thing, but then cut to the future after everything goes the right way. Oh, he's Barack Obama. He's the president of the United States. And this was early in the Obama days. You hadn't seen a lot of people do Obama. And Keegan did a killer Obama, which, if you watch the show, you know, Jordan did the killer Obama.
Yeah.
But I watched the show and I saw Jordan doing the Obama. I was like, what? Jordan does Obama too? Like, Keegan does a killer Obama. But that's how brilliant they both are. Like, they're like, well, I guess either one of us could do it. Like, people don't know that Keegan does a dead on Obama impression. And I saw his long before I saw Jordan's.
Nice.
But yeah, he's in that show. So it's like things like that that we get to play with. Like, what would be the black version of this character's life being better in the future? You know? So, and we try to be as specific as possible with things like that, you know?
Yeah.
As opposed to just saying, like, oh, he has a lot of money and he has a nice house. Like, well, that would be the same in a white movie. So what's the black on that, you know? How can we amplify it?
What's the weirdest it's ever gotten?
It never gets weird for us on stage because the cast is so strong, you never are at, like, if I get up there and I'm not sure what to do or what it doesn't matter because the people I'm on stage with are so good.
Right, right.
So, but I mean, like, audience wise, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think, like, I know, of course, we get weird suggestions, but one of the things we clarify at the beginning of the show is they have to be iconic movies, meaning you can't just scream out, you know, The Bicycle Thief, because the audience
has Cinema Paradosa, right? Like,
right, because like, it's not because we can't do it, it's because it's the audience doesn't know it, so then they won't enjoy our send up of something they've never seen as much, you know. So, but yeah, so weird. I can't think of anything weird. I'm trying to think on.
I think I'm just trying to dig
something that went wrong, maybe in a show.
For me, I don't know, with the stuff I'm doing on the page, I'm always looking for like the one thing that's a little different. I'm just, you know, want to just get in a conversation about just some moments over the that were just like, I don't know, you know, for you or for the cat, just some things that were just memorable. They don't have to be the top five or anything. I'm just, I just want to give people an idea. I mean, this is to me is kind of a commercial for the show. Yeah. So, you know, if you're selling that, how are you going to sell that is the question I would have.
I mean, it's pretty simple. The show has always been an easy sell because this is what I always tell people.
Right.
You take the title of an iconic movie like Star Wars or Titanic, and then we improvise the black version of it. And if people, when they hear that, they're just like, I got to go see this show.
Yeah.
So it's always, that's the pitch for it. But trying to think of like unusual things that happened. I'm trying to even think
like, if you're going to make, say you're going to make a 5-minute commercial with little chunks of, say, stuff you have, you know, stuff that you have recorded. It's just literal show. I'm just curious on what those would be. Is that a better way to put it? I know that's putting on the spot and that's probably hard. And if you can't think of it, it's fine. I want to just give people like a snapshot of some of the moments
of the actual performance.
Like, well, what are some stories
I give you like some ideas. Like, I give you like some of the titles we've done because we always like we'll get the real movie and then we'll say we'll ask the audience what's the black version title. So like Jaws was called Catfish, and Silence of the Lambs was called Why You Eating People. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was called Damn They Small. And then Pretty Woman was called Hot Mess.
Okay.
My Fair Lady was called She's Aight. Fiddler on the Roof was called Rapper in the Basement. Nice. So those are things that, you know, every show, and we get those from the audience. You know, the audience.
Was there Jewish humor in that? And that did you do
no,
any?
No, because we're doing the black version. Songs? No, because right, we do the black version. So we have to go away from whatever the real thing was to do the black version.
Right, but I think that's the humor of like mixing up the two and using that culture to find the blackness in it. To me, would
right. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I don't know.
We do our version of that movie, that story. Yeah. But then instead of it being, you know, Jewish traditions we're discussing,
So what would be, if you had a song, what would be If I Were a Rich Man for the Black Version?
Okay, let me think, because I don't remember from our show what the song titles were, but because it was years ago. But If I Were a Rich Man,
what would that, you know?
I give you, like, it'd probably be something like, If I Hit the Numbers, you know, right. If I Won the Lottery,
yeah,
you know, if, you know, If My Man Pay His Child Support, it'd be something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's great.
It'd be something like that, probably, you know.
All right. You know, on your influences, on kind of what got you into acting, into comedy, right, into improv, mm-hmm, who were some of the folks, whether, you know, I don't know, I like to, like, ask people when they were younger, but I'm also curious in terms of just being part of the Groundlings, who were some of the people overall in your life that really influenced you in terms of taking this path in your life?
I mean, that's a long list, but, like, as a child, I would say the biggest influences on me that my comic persona probably grew out of is Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor.
Nice.
So, Richard Pryor is the greatest stand-up that ever lived.
Oh, yeah.
And then Eddie was so, just, he was such a big star when I was in high school. So I was in high school, like, when, maybe junior high or high school, when, like, Beverly Hills Cop came out, you know?
Yeah. Were there certain movies that you kind of obsessed about or watch a lot in terms of either Richard or Eddie?
Well, yeah. I mean, all of Eddie's movies I watched. I mean, part of the thing that works for me with the Black Version is I am a cinephile, and
yeah,
all those movies, because I grew up in the 80s, we had HBO and we had the Movie Channel when I was a kid.
Oh, nice.
And back in those days, HBO and the Movie Channel, both of them were the same. They played the same, like, let's say 6 or 7 movies in the morning and then repeat them at night.
Right, right.
And then the next day, they take one out and throw in a different movie, but then it'd be five movies from yesterday. So, and it was just a rotation. That's all it was, just a rotation. So I watched all the 80s movies 1,000 times because I'd be sitting in front of my TV all day as a kid and just watch. So I'd watch the same movies twice in a day. Cause, you know, you're running in and out, you turn on the TV, it's Grease again. You saw it this morning, it's on the air. You saw it yesterday and you're watching it again. And you're glad to watch it. You know, I'm enjoying it. So when we do these movies, these are the movies we're getting. It's like all those iconic films is what people yell out. And, like, I know all these movies like the back of my
head. Yeah, I'd have to spray.
It seems like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. It seems like that's a great background to do what you do, because otherwise you couldn't really, knowing those movies back and forth.
Yeah. It's mainly for our director, because she has to know those movies. And
right,
she does.
Right.
Because we're just actors at that point being directed, you know? So we don't really have to know the movie. And I actually find that I have more fun when I actually don't know the movie.
Is there any kind of common, like, within the group, what's the common influences that connect you all in terms of comedy or, you know, who you are? Like, what connects you guys as a team?
I mean, truthfully, we're all a bunch of nerds. We're all nerds. Like, you know, definitely comedy. All of us are comedy nerds. We're all, like, entertainment nerds, like, not just comedy. We know all, you know, we all love movies. We all love TV. Like Daniel Gaither, I say, because, like, Daniel Gaither and I, we went through Groundlings together, right? Daniel and I started in the Groundlings together.
Okay.
We write together a lot. And one of the things I always say about Daniel is, from writing with her so much, is that the two of us pretty much grew up sitting in front of the same TV. Because when we write together, it's like she didn't have to explain any joke she was going for. I didn't have to explain any joke I'm going for. We just, like, we knew, like, if I say this, then she knew to say that. And it was like, oh, we grew up on all the same television shows.
One more question. Are there any movies that you've been dying for someone to bring up that they never have?
I'm a big Barbra Streisand fan. I told you I'm a nerd. So any of her movies, A, because I've seen them so many times. But really, like I can't believe, like, we've never gotten, I don't know if we ever got A Star Is Born. We might have done that. Because of the Bradley Cooper Lady Gaga movie. But like, I would love to do The Way We Were, you know. Like, that's one of my favorites. So I would love to do that.
What would that be called in your estimation?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of
I'd love I'm sorry I'm putting you on the spot.
It'd be called Back in the Day.
Okay.
Back in the day.
What was that movie that she did with Nick Nolte where they were, like, lovers?
Oh, The Prince of Tides. I would love to do The Prince of Tides.
That would be a, what would that one be? What would you concept that one on? No, I'm not worried about the title. What would the concept be? What would the black concept be?
Yeah, well, my version would be instead of her being a therapist, she'd be a pastor. So you'd be going to talk to your pastor about your problems. So there are some times where people will yell out a lot of suggestions and we end up, the audience votes on what final title we're going to do. And sometimes we're going like, oh God, I hope we get that one. It's like, it doesn't even get any applause. I'm like, oh man, that would be so funny.
What are some of the ones that weren't racially problematic that you guys have passed on that aren't because of race?
Not a lot. We don't turn down a lot because the audience, first of all, most of the movie titles they yell out, I mean, you know, Hollywood being Hollywood, there's a ton of options we have for all white movies. So
do you give them a theme or a category ever when you're starting? Do you give them like 70s, 80s?
Well, except like at Christmas time, we'll say, give us a Christmas.
Right, movie. Okay.
Halloween will ask for a scary movie.
I gotcha.
Other than that, no. So I'm trying to think of something that if we turn down a movie, it's always only because either the movie's already black, meaning like it's got a huge, even if it's not an all black movie, it's got a big black cast, or it's already a very black story.
Right.
So there's no way to really send it up. Or it's because we know the audience won't know.
I know we talk about movies, Eddie Murphy, but I'm curious on like influence of stand-up and also sketch comedy, which is a tough question because I don't know. Well, in general, I mean,
I grew up on SNL. I grew up watching SNL. I probably started in the Eddie Murphy years and I've been watching it ever since. SNL is why I went to Groundlings. Like, I wanted to be on SNL. I was a sketch guy. That it was. I mean, not anymore. I mean, I'm so past it now, you know. But in my 20s and 30s, I was all about sketch comedy.
Yeah. Are you ever an SCTV person?
Yeah, I grew up watching it.
Fucking, to me, my aesthetics, I prefer that more than SNL, but.
I get that. I'll say this, and I agree with you on that, but I'll say the reason for it is because SNL's live. So SNL doesn't have the quality control.
Right.
Has Kids in the Hall, Mad TV. Like, people will talk about like, all these other shows are so much better. And I go like, but I wrote on SNL for a season.
Oh wow! What did you what season did you write on?
2003, 2004, and I complained too, like why this, why that? And when I worked there, I realized, oh, they don't have a choice. Meaning, you do the show Saturday, you got to write another show for next Saturday. So on Tuesdays you write, on Wednesdays you table read like 40 sketches that are going to be 12 sketches in the show. And I explain to people, what you don't understand is whether there's 12 good sketches that week or not, 12 sketches are going on the air. The other shows are like, this sketch doesn't work, we're not going to air it. Or this sketch doesn't work, we won't shoot it. We don't have 12 good sketches, but we're shooting 12 sketches. So we might have 8 good sketches. So we're going to have 4 bad sketches because we got to fill those 90 minutes. So that's what people didn't understand. The other thing, like, people say like, oh, their sketches, why do the cast have to read? Why don't they memorize? Like, during the live show, while the cast is on TV, somebody comes to the writer and says, you have to cut a minute out of your sketch, we're long. The actors don't know this is happening.
Oh, shit.
They have to look at the things to know what's in the script because scripts change while they're on the air.
What were some sketches you got that either you were part of or that you originated that got into the show? Yeah.
I not a lot of memorable. It was so long ago, but like the two I remember for sure was we did a parody of Punk'd when Justin Timberlake hosted the first time.
Who was the cast when you were writing for it? Who was in the cast when you were writing for it? If you can remember.
It was a big cast. We had Jimmy and Tina were still there. It was Jimmy Fallon's last season. Maya Rudolph, Will Forte, Fred Armisen, Rachel Dratch, Amy Poehler.
Nice. That's a good, yeah, Darryl, you got it.
Hammond. Keegan, Keenan Thompson, Finesse Mitchell, J.B. Smoove was on the writing staff, Jason Sudeikis was on the writing staff.
Wow.
I'm sure there was some people I'm not thinking. A lot of fun. But yeah, so it's like when people say like, oh, I like this show, I'm like, you don't get it. Like SNL, it made me appreciate the show more and made me even more of a fan of the show after working there and realizing like, oh my God, yeah, this is why. The sketches are too long. It's like, yeah, because they can't also like, they'll go, why are the sketches so long? Because they can't build 40 sets. Like sketches have to run a certain amount of time because they can only build so many sets. You know, you can't have like build a whole set for a sketch that's going to be 45 seconds like you can do on a scripted show. Oh, that's just a 45 second quick little thing. Yeah, we can't. We don't have space. It's limited space on this one stage. So it's great. It's really great.
Is there anything that you're allowed to legally talk about that you're kind of looking forward to in terms of, we can stick to improv, or in terms of anything happening at the Groundlings or other things that are, I don't know what the rules are. I don't want to get anyone in trouble myself, more you, but I'm just curious on any projects that you, that aren't TV or film. I don't want to.
Oh, well, I mean, I do another show, if people who are listeners are in LA, I do another show at the Groundlings, a weekly show. Another long form show called The Crazy Uncle Joe Show.
Okay.
That's been running for over 20 years now. I'm one of the founding members of that show. It's a long form show. It's called The Crazy Uncle Joe Show, and it's Wednesday nights at the Groundlings. So,
what's the concept for that show, if you can share?
It's what we do is we come out and we do three separate scenes based on audience suggestions. So the first scene might be like, where do these two people work? They do that scene. Scene ends. Next scene might be, what are they doing? They're digging a ditch. Next scene might be like, what are they doing? They're doing the laundry, whatever. After that third scene is done, we don't get any more suggestions from the audience. And the cast just spins ideas off of those first three scenes, creating different storylines based on those first three scenes. Yeah, so you have to kind of see it to get it. It sounds more complicated than it is. Once you watch it, you get it. So it's a lot of fun.
But thank you so much. It's really a pleasure meeting you. And I'd seen your work a bunch. I forgot you were in Community. You were awesome in that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. You want me to tell you my favorite story? He's got some great stories, Hollywood stories. Like, anybody, whenever I meet somebody who was famous in the 80s, like one of the first things I ask, did you ever meet Michael Jackson? And I want to hear that story. And he has a Michael Jackson story. And I also asked Julia Sweeney that, and she had a Michael Jackson story. But anyway, but that's not my favorite story of his. My favorite story was when he did Buffy. It was the first job he'd been offered after his scandal. And he said, and this made me fall in love with Paul Reubens so much when he told me this. He said, I told them, yes, I would do it, but only if I could look exactly like I look in my mugshot. They said yes. He said, I want it in my contract, right? I get to have the long hair and I get to have my goatee.
Yeah.
He said, sure, put in the contract, done. His first day on set, he shows up. They're about to shoot a scene. Donald Sutherland walks up. Donald Sutherland is in the movie. He's got a full beard, right? Donald Sutherland goes, he's got a beard? I've got a beard. We can't both have beards. People won't be able to tell us apart. Now, of course, Donald Sutherland's like 40 years older than Paul. But so Donald Sutherland's having a fit.
Oh,
like,
shit.
He's got a shave, right? He's having a fit. Paul goes, I'm going to my trailer. Let me know when we're ready to work. He goes to his trailer. Knock, knock. Producers come in. Hey, Paul. Sorry, but Donald, we're going to ask you to shave. Paul goes, no, I'm not. You're going to have to shave. No, I don't. Read my contract. I don't have to shave. And that was the end of it. And I just love that story. My fear is that everybody thinks like, oh, he's so humiliated and all that. And he's like, no, I want to look like that picture. I don't give a crap. I want people to see me look like the picture in my mugshot. I was like, that tells you everything about Paul's mentality about life. Like, I don't care.
I feel like from what I know about him, what I've heard about him, it seems like it's the gag is commitment to the character.
Oh,
and I love that he takes that in negotiating, not just, and I think that to me is like, you know, you can tell he's, you know, you can tell he's probably giggling as he's doing this to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
He's probably serious, but he's also like, funny. How much can I push this thing as well?
I'm sure he thought, oh, they're trying to humiliate me, put this mugshot out there. And he's like, I don't care.
All right, man, you have a great day, and thanks again for your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hey, Karen.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how's it going? Thanks for making time for this. I know you're in this function, you direct the show. But are you also an improv performer or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Jordan through the Groundlings. We were both in the Groundlings together. So I still perform. You know, like him, he's more like, he's like a writer actor. I'm more of a director actor. Because I'm directing the current show, The Groundlings. And
Did you come? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Did you come out, did you train in the Groundlings as well, or not so much?
Uh-huh. Everyone who's in the Groundlings has gone through the school. That's how you become a company member. You have to go through the program.
And I've been asking people, because of Paul Rubin's passing, if you knew Paul, and just kind of to send my condolences. I don't know if you were close to him or not.
Yeah, Paul was a really great guy. We did a show. Well, Jordan and I were in it. It was called the Beverly Winwood Showcase. And Paul was in it at its inception, which is maybe like, it's got to be at least 15 years ago, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And then and he would come and do shows. He's just really sweet, very quiet, you know, really nice guy.
I've realized how, especially with a lot of the tributes and stuff, how kind he was to people he knew, but also to just the strangers. And
he didn't like rebuff them. He was very, very gracious. And, you know, he always sent these really great, like, peewee Christmas cards I got every year. He, you know, really thoughtful, really, really thoughtful guy.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss.
We didn't even know he was sick. Just only a handful of people that were in his inner circle even knew he was sick. He would donate. We'd have benefits, and he would donate memorabilia to auction off, and he'd sign it. And, you know, he did a lot of cool things like that.
Yeah. I guess let's go back to the beginning. Like, how did you get involved with the show? I know Jordan was, you know, was the impetus for starting it. So I'm just curious on your connection. But how did you get involved with the Black version?
Okay, Jordan was doing these little videos that were spoofs. Like, he would take like iconic scenes from films or numbers, like Summer Lovin' was Ghetto Lovin', and he changed the lyrics and do a video. And so I directed him in one that we did that was a spoof on When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, nice. What was that one called?
You know what? We did the Black version of the movie. I don't remember what the actual video was called, but it was like when we did it, Harry Met Sally in the Black version, it was called When Keisha Boned Ray Ray. but the video is just the scene in the where she has an orgasm in the coffee shop. It was Jordan was in it. I forgot the girl who played Sally, but then Octavia Spencer was the woman that goes, "I'll have what she's having."
Oh wow!
You know, and so we just started doing. He was doing those videos, and then he goes, "We got together," and he goes, "I really want to do this as an improv show. It could be really funny." And so we just kind of like got together and plotted out what we get some scenes, and then we do like a second act, and we try to figure out what the second act would be. You know, it would be like DVD extras or deleted scenes or product placement or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And we got a date at the Groundlings, and we just started doing it. And we asked Phil and Danielle and Jordan and myself are Groundling alum. That's how we got the Groundling Theater.
Nice.
But then we wanted to get other people. And so, you know, Jordan reached out to people that he had worked with. And I had worked with Gary on some like Lifetime show that we had done, some like semi-improvised. And it was like, we found out what a great improviser he is. He's out of Atlanta. Then Steve was doing, a bunch of us had guested on Reno 911. I had done an episode or two, Jordan had, so we reached out to Cedric. And then at the time, we reached out to two guys who were, they were Second City, and it was Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And Keegan had just done, like, they had both done, like, SNL or Mad TV, I think. You know, so that was our first couple shows, was those, they were in it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and was Phil Mad TV as well, I thought?
Yes.
Okay.
Phil was one of the originating cast members of Mad TV.
Nice. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know the two other women that well in their work, but I mean, I was a huge fan of Gary back to Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah.
And just Phil from Mad TV, and just seeing him around. And Cedric, I got to interview Cedric, and I don't know, he, you know, just a wonderful human being. It's odd to say this, but it's always nice when you come across an actor who you just believe, who it's about the work, and it's about being generous, and it's about, you know, there's a realness to that, to authenticity to him because of that. And you don't, yeah. I'm not saying that, you know, that people are like that, but it's rare. I don't think everybody is as generous. And
well,
kind.
Sadly, it's true. I hate to be jaded, but it is. In other words,
yeah,
it seems like it should be so easy to be generous and to be easy to work with, but that's not necessarily the case.
But know? It seems like the team you have, at least from knowing the members, seems to be working in that way.
That's the only reason we've been doing this show for 12 years.
Yeah.
Almost 13 years, because we like each other, we trust each other, and everyone's really cool.
Yeah, I want to ask. I got a few questions. I'm curious. Over the years, if you think, can think about it, what were some of the, I don't know, the ones you did that you just were more enjoy. You know, the ones that you did that were special or enjoyable. What are some of the? And I like to kind of build in storytelling in the conversation. So if there's any stories you have on just working on the show for, was it 12 years now or more?
Maybe more. Maybe it's 13 plus. You'd have to ask Jordan about that. I'm not sure. It's been a long time. We've been doing it, yeah. And because we know other people, we got a lot of guest casts. You know, like, you know, Maya Rudolph would come in and guest. Wayne Brady's guested a bunch. Oh, he's amazing. You know, obviously. And just, it's been really great how we get a bunch of really great guests, you know? I mean, I it's hard for me because we always, our running joke is, what was the other show we did? What did we call it? What did we do last week?
I don't want to put you in a spot, but I'm just curious if you have any reflections in any piece of working on this over the years that is like a special moment you're okay sharing. If not, we can move on. We can move on to
the
next question.
Here's the thing. I think it's subjective. I do remember we did Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and Keegan was the prince, and he sang Prince numbers through the whole thing. Which was so awesome. Great because he's a singer, you know, so yeah. The band would just jam on Prince songs and he would just go for it, you know.
Oh, that's nice.
And memorable things for me are doing shows. We just did a run at we went to New York.
Oh wow.
And so we did one called our version of Honey I Shrunk the Kids was dang they small. Which is so funny. The titles are so funny. And then, you know, Kennedy Center, we did some really great shows there. You know, I have a lot of great memory. We did Mary Poppins, I think, and Maya was Mary Poppins, but I forgot her name. It was some stupid name. We also did, you know, shows. We're based in the Groundlings, but we have gone other places.
Nice.
To do the show. You know, we'll go on the road every once in a while with it. It's pretty fun.
So yeah. I haven't seen it. I have a partner who lives out there who went to the last show to kind of get you provide some feedback for the episode. And I'm curious, it was, you know, I talked to Jordan a few days ago and I was unclear a little bit on how your role was, but then he clarified a little bit. I'm curious just if you can explain your role in terms of directing it while it's happening. And how that kind of if that changed at all, or how that came to be, and how that works for you.
I do watch a lot of movies, and so I remember really odd scenes from them. So what you need to do is we don't have to do it. Obviously, it's not the exact movie, but I've got to be able to be a few steps ahead so I can gauge what scenes we're going to do and how I can gauge the first act of the show based on what they're doing. So if they lay out some weird piece of information, let's say, honey, I blew up the kids, instead of like blowing up insects, they blow up a rat. I got to go, wait, we go back and we see what happened to the rat. I have to kind of obligate those things, and it'll go in an obtuse direction based on the information that they're laying out. But I still have to guide it towards the story. In other words, if we're doing Top Gun, they weren't fighter pilots, they were FedEx pilots. So my job is to give them fun Top Gun kind of nicknames, kind of, define the rivalry. So it's kind of like their version of it. And then based on being FedEx pilots, what's the cargo? What's the conflict? How is it resolved? Are the bad guys, like when we did that, the bad guys, you know, instead of being in Afghanistan, wherever they were, they worked for Brown. So now we have that kind of rivalry. So we're taking the satire of it and transferring that kind of information towards maybe a light plot that was in the original movie.
When you say they, are you discussing it with the audience or are you discussing it with the cast?
They have to do it. They have to do whatever I tell them to do. That's what's flying without a net. It's really, I always get this little adrenaline dump right before because I don't know what the audience is going to pick. We don't pre-plan that. So as soon as they pick a movie, I'm already kind of going, well, okay, what's our version of it called? Right? And the audience comes up with that stuff. And then, oh, what's a theme song? All right, let's go with that title. And I have to just sign everybody. So I have to be aware of who I'm using and when.
But so that that process though is with the audience up until...
The audience on the spot until I actually call the actors up and I try to pick up the story wherever we're going to pick it up, wherever I decide to pick it up. So if it's, he just broke up with his girlfriend and now we're taking them on the road trip, I'll try to set them up, you know, so people who haven't seen the movie can kind of follow along and the people who have go, oh, I know where she's doing. Like if we're doing Terminator, I've seen that movie so many times, right? So I'm going to give that the robot character a catchphrase instead of I'll be back. It's like later, bitches, or something like that. So I can connect the iconic aspects of it to whatever the actors can do or whatever they blurt out or whatever the audience. And then I have to do it within a, you know, a 40 minute time frame to bring it all up to a conclusion so that we can get to the DVD extras. So it's just kind of like juggling time, using people, setting up scenes, connecting the scenes, using what the actors bring and also what the audience is shouting out and having some sort of vague connection to the movie itself.
That sounds like an insanely hard process.
It is.
That make most people dizzy.
Paper, I've got to write it down. I've got to recycle the names, you know, so that we can, because I'll have to keep reminding them, you know, in other words, it's my job also to go, remember his name is, you know, Lucius, that's his name, because that's what the audience is about. And then the hardest part is to bring it to conclusion in a timely fashion and tying up the loose ends.
Is there, like I was talking to Jordan a little bit, and I was curious if there was, I know that Groundlings doesn't really do Harold, but I was wondering if there was a process built in that functions that way that you've developed so that there's, so it makes sense.
No, my process is just control. You know, I'll black out the scene. If we've gotten to a joke and I know that I've got four more scenes to get to an ending, I'll cut that scene short and then set up the next scene based on what they've said. Oh, he says they're going to CVS. Let's see that. And I'll just cut and jump cut. And, you know, it's like someone going, okay, blackout, free, you know, or I'll tell them to freeze. And then I have to be mindful too of where I can insert songs, if songs are required, or to get those guys to do something musical, or if it's appropriate to have a dance number in there based on what they're doing, if they're, you know, like, especially if we're doing things like, you know, our version of West Side Story or our version of, you know, there are certain things that have iconic like song and dance moments. I have to go, oh, so I have to keep in the back of my mind what kind of songs we've done in the past that would fit in there. Oh, this is perfect for a duet. Oh, shoot. So I have to go note to myself, knowing that this is a love story, I can insert a duet in there or a four guy dance number or a rap scene. That's the part for me. It's just to be responsible for the six actors, make sure they are all equally represented, and I'm telling a story.
Do you have a live band? How are you doing music? Is there a live band?
Oh my god, we have the best band ever. So Jordan, his cousin, is this amazing drummer who then got all these, we used to use these two guys that played for the Groundlings, and then Jordan said, no, you know what, I want to get black musicians in here. And I said, yeah. That'd be so these are all guys that have, they're professionals. So they've played with like Dave Koz, the Jacksons, Toto. They go on tour all the time. So if Stacy, who's the he's our musical director slash drummer. If he can't do it, he'll find other, like we have like two main standby keyboardists. So we have a 5-piece band. We have drums,
wow,
keyboard, guitar, bass, and a violin. And sometimes if the violinist can't make it, we may just call in like a guy that plays trumpet. It's kind of amazing. And they will jump in. So in other words, we'll rehearse certain songs, but we don't know what context they'll be, and they have to improvise all the lyrics, but we can at least musically kind of rehearse that part.
So you will, and you'll pick certain songs before the suggestion or after?
I will decide what song I want to use.
Okay.
Let's say they've rehearsed, let's say Shallow, the actual song Shallow from A Star Is Born.
Okay.
And something in the scene that will set that up nicely for me. Instead of calling it Shallow, it's called, you know, I don't know, some 2-syllable word, or, you know, or asshole or something like that, right? The name of their song, but the band knows they're going to play like a version of Shallow. But we also have them improvise songs. In other words, they're going to audition this with this song. What's it called? What's the style? And the audience will go, oh, it's opera reggae. So they just have to make up an opera reggae song, and then they have to sing it.
Is there a I've taken a few classes in improv, but I took a class on like musical, like Broadway musical theater improv, and I'm wondering, is there any structure within the improvisation? Like, I know there was a certain thing where you had like you kind of knew a structure so that it worked. I don't remember the structure. It was something about like rhyme scheme, and then there was a chorus that had to reflect, I don't remember exactly, but is there anything like
right that? There's different schools of thought, but when you are taking song improv, especially if you're not really familiar with music, and even if you are, you know, you want to like kind of fit the musical line. There's like there's an A B rhyme scheme, there's an A B
right.
There's an AABB rhyme scheme, then there's usually a chorus, and then you can decide if you're going to split the chorus. In other words, if I'm doing the chorus, maybe I sing the first line, you sing the second, I rhyme myself, and then you rhyme yourself, or I sing a line, then you have to rhyme it, then you have to set up a sentence, and then I have to rhyme it.
It's gotcha. Yeah.
It depends on what you do, but it's pretty, because they kind of know music, it'll be like verse, verse, chorus, verse.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Something
like that.
It seems like there's a few people that have more singing experience, but also some Broadway chops.
If you're comfortable musically, it's going to be a lot easier for you, because yeah, you're not going to get freaked out, and you won't lose the musical line, even if they have to kind of vamp for like a, you know, like say for one line of music or one bar, and then you jump back in. Like Naima is a great singer. Danielle's a singer. Cedric's an amazing singer.
You know,
Gary's a good singer too.
It's
funny, it sounds amazing.
It was great to learn that Cedric had played the lead in forget the musical, with the barber and the
Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, and just uh-huh. You know, yeah, it was, you know, he's also a big Broadway fan, but you know, I'm a huge musical theater freak. So it's always nice to have this conversation.
Oh, you would love it. Like, I'll tell you, like Cedric and Danielle do a duet based on Shallow. You know, Danielle and Gary do like a rap song based on Erykah Badu's song. That, you know, they all can like.
Yeah.
No, Gary's an amazing rapper. It's mind blowing how good he is. They all have, you know, they all have a skill set, but they the through line is that they're all very accomplished improvisers.
Yeah,
and that, I mean, you know, you have to listen.
Yeah, I'm in Philly, so, but I'm planning to try to figure out at some point to just come to LA for 2 or 3 weeks and just check out all the stuff that I've been missing living over here. Or mm-hmm. Unless you can, you know, where I'll keep an eye out if you guys are, you know, I mean it's easy to get to New York. I, you know, I'm only 2 hours from there, but I'd love to check it out if you get, you know.
Yeah. I mean, if you're ever in LA, I mean, we do the show once a month. It's usually the third Monday of every month.
Yeah.
And Jordan does have some archival stuff of the shows. We try to tape as many of the shows as we can.
I'd love to see some of that. I have a partner who does research, and he went to the show you did last month and just loved it. And
it was a good one. He saw a really good one. I forgot the movie already, but it was a good one. I remember it going, oh my God, this is so good. You know, and if they're, you know, what was it? Anyway.
In terms of directing, like, are you doing any like, I guess you're throwing the ideas, but are you like within that, are you directing, like whispering to them, do this, do that? Or once they start, you kind of back off. How does that work?
Once they start the scene, I usually try to set it up. I don't say they go up there. I kind of force them to start somewhere.
Okay.
In other words, if it's, God, I wish I could remember what we did last month so I could give you an exact.
That's okay. I mean, you know, I don't need exact. I'm just curious.
But I will set things like, if let's say it is, I'm just trying to think of a really decent one. I can't even remember.
That's okay. I don't want to put you on the spot. Sorry about
but
that.
But we did like, okay, so we did Taken, right?
Okay.
And so I'm not going to go, well, they're just going to go up there and we're going to meet them. I get what they're doing. In other words, Jordan is the dad, all right? Okay. What's his job? He's retired what? Okay. Instead, he's a security guard at a mall. So he's a mall cop. He's not, you know, an FBI ex operative. He's just a mall cop. Okay, what's his name? All right, he's going to his daughter's birthday party. What do you know? Where does she live? And they'll say, oh, they live, you know, in Compton or whatever. They'll give their own version of it. Okay, so I'll set them up. Right now, he's bringing her a gift, and she doesn't like it. That's how I'll set up the scene. So they have a goal that, you know, then we'll get to see what the results are.
And are you picking the actors at this point? Or
yes, okay. I cast it in my head. In other words, Gary, you know, you're going to be, you know, like if it were like Gary, your Jabba the Hutt, Jordan, you're, you know what I mean? You're Han Solo, and Cedric, you're Luke. Okay. But their names aren't that. Their name isn't Luke. It's what? It's Lucius. Oh, Jabba the Hutt is, you know, J-Dog. They'll just make those up. The audience will, because you know, try to involve the audience as much as possible. You know, and then I'll set it that way. So I get names, I'll get the alternate universe that we're going to build upon, and then I'll set them up as to where they are. We'll never start at the beginning. We'll always kind of start in the middle, because, you know, that's always a big rule of improv. You want to start in the middle of something so you can get something going. Right. So it's not the one thing I try not to do is make it conversational.
So the first scene is always about 45 minutes or so, 40?
No, the first act is 45
minutes.
First act.
Minutes. Sorry, that's what I mean.
It's just a bunch of scenes.
Yeah.
And it'll, and we'll wrap it up. Then we take a short intermission, and then we'll do like a PSA. Let's say that, we shot this movie instead of Washington, D.C., it takes place in Springfield, Missouri. So the city of Springfield, make up a cause. It could be save the squirrels. And they do, like, they play the actors and they're doing a PSA about that. Then we do auditions, lost auditions that you may have seen.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
If you bought the DVD. So what are these actors auditioning with? And they have to make it up. In other words, they're doing a scene from Flowers in the Attic. They don't have to know it. They just have to improvise it. In other words, if they don't know it, they don't want it. You don't want improvisers to go, I don't know that.
Right, so right.
I'm going to make it up, like Shakespeare.
Yes, and give me 20 minutes.
You know? Exactly.
It really
don't
work.
Judge it. Don't roll your eyes. Don't say, I don't get it. Just embrace the fact that you don't know. Ignorance is bliss in improv.
And are you, now, in that process, that's about like 20 minutes, or how long is that, the second?
The second act?
Yeah,
it's shorter. It's like 20 minutes.
Okay.
25 minutes tops, because they each do an audition, either two person or one person. We do maybe a PSA, or we'll do like a deleted scene. What's a deleted scene that you didn't see in the first act that you'd like to see? And then we end with a song.
And and are you kind of taking notes during the first act to kind of figure that out, or are the actors involved with that, or is that also the audience giving you those suggestions?
Every suggestion I get from the audience, the actors just go up there and and do it. They're not involved in deciding what to do. They don't get to discuss it.
I got
they
you.
Don't whisper and go, we're going to plan some stuff. This is literally, they're doing it as you see it. They're thrown, they sit out where they're visible in front of the audience, and I'll just call them up and they'll run up on stage. They're watching.
I thought it might be different because you have a break, and the since the second act is a reflection of the first, but no, that makes more sense, obviously.
The second act kind of only is totally separate because they're getting to play different characters. They're playing different actors auditioning.
It's the same world as the movie you've chosen. Is it based? Mm-mm. Oh, so it's not connected at all to the first.
Not
movie
really.
You've chosen.
The only thing that it has something to do with is an outside kind of visual representation of it. I mean, like a character kind of thing. Like it's kind of just obtusely referenced. In other words, let's say that we do like Ferris Bueller, which the right. movie takes place in Chicago, but where does ours take place? And they shout out, oh, it takes place in Detroit. So the only thing that the second act will obligate is Detroit.
Gotcha, okay, it's interesting.
Detroit asks the actors to do a PSA, what's it about? Oh, you know, bring back the Lions, okay, or whatever. And that's, so it'll have something to do with Detroit, but it has nothing to do with the movie, okay? They'll play actors in the movie, but they won't, they're referencing their characters, not the movie. You'll see. And then the scenes, the auditions have nothing to do with the movie because they're using a different type of different piece to audition okay. with.
Nice. And then interesting.
At the end song does have something to do with the movie because I will come back and reference different characters that they played in the first act. And they'll do a song based on what that character wanted or needed at that time.
I got about one or two questions. What's the common, I don't know if language is the right word. What's the connection between you and all the actors in terms of your aesthetic, comedic taste? Is there a certain kind of language you've developed and way of working as a team that, you know, in some way or not so much? Like,
I think there's mutual trust. That's about it. We've been doing it for so long. I'm sure that certain people go, oh, I would have done this, I would have done that, but that's the nature of improv. I think they trust me. I know Jordan does. And so I feel confident that my goal is always to make everyone look good. You know what I mean? And to give the audience something amazing with these really talented improvisers. I always say these are the best improvisers I've worked with, not the best Black improvisers. They're just fucking great. So I don't think that aesthetically we differ that much, because ultimately you just want it to be funny. You want it to be connected and you want everyone to have a moment.
Yeah, I mean, when Jordan's answer to that was, we're all big comedy nerds, which was enough. That makes sense, yeah. You know?
And they laugh at each other as much as the audience does. It's like getting a front row seat, watching your fellow cast members just like make you and everybody laugh.
And in terms of like, I mean, I see, I could be wrong, but it seems like you're improvising as well in this whole process.
Yeah.
I'm curious on your training. How do you build in your own improv training, your improv experience into this other form? How does that play out for you?
I think when you're teaching, because I have taught at the Groundlings for decades, I teach improv at the American Film Institute as well.
Nice.
To directors. Like anything, when you teach and everything, you have to kind of trust it. It's just, what would I do if I were up there? You know, what's the next logical step? When I'm sitting there, I always like put myself in their position and go, oh, there was an opportunity. And they still get notes, you know, we still kind of like have some feedback, you know, not that you're like going, you should have done this, but you know, it just kind of keeps you fresh. So for me, I do improvise. I still perform at the Groundlings every once in a while, just to get my performance, you know, yah-yahs out. You know, I enjoy it. I enjoy improvising. I think it's really fun and it's scary. I'm always nervous before a show. And I think you should be. You can't bat 1,000. Even, you know, like, come on, baseball, you know, you never bats 1,000. If you bat 300, 400, you're doing great. Just be able to sit back and go, oh, I should have been the ant, or shoot, I should have, you know, sold him that cabbage. I mean, all I tell my students is, hate yourself on the drive home. Just don't do it on stage.
Right. No. And I think, like, you know, there's people that talk more about like how like self-healing kind of comes in. I mean, I think doing a process where you're not judging yourself, you're not judging other people, is really valuable. I mean, yes, anding is a way of life if you think about it.
It is. And collaboration. It's kind of like the C word to some, but ultimately it's like, you know what? It actually adds to your stable of information and experience if you do yes and, if you do consider someone else's contribution to either a scene or whatever. And it adds to actually the believability of your scene, because you're taking that information and you're kind of like adding to it, as opposed to going, yeah, whatever, let me talk about me now.
Right.
If I label you, it's much more interesting, and it's a gift to you as opposed to labeling myself.
And one thing I learned about just like judgment in general of others or self, that it's kind of like circular, meaning if you're judging yourself as a person, you're going to judge other people, vice versa.
Yes. And then all of it, it's like a big snowball that's going down, as opposed, you know, it's just like, it's like, oh, now I'm judging you. Now I'm judging that he didn't yes and me. Now I'm mad. Now I'm frustrated. And pretty soon you're not listening, and it's over. It's hard to do for a lot of people. You know what I mean? It's like, oh man, they're getting all the laughs. Oh, it's all this weird kind of like inner turmoil that you have. And if you just let that go, and I think it's just going to come with experience, right? It's fun. Like, it's like improv. Like you were saying, when you're killing it, it feels so good. And you come off going, I don't know what I did, but it was fun. And when you're not, it's because you're struggling and you're pushing and you're not listening. If you think about it, the ones where you really killed, you were really just listening. You were in the moment. You weren't worrying about where the scene was going. You're just focused on your scene partner.
The last thing I'll ask you is there anything in terms of your career? I know we can't really talk about any studio stuff. I don't want to, you know, break the strike in any way, but I'm just curious if anything you're working on in the world of improv, or you directing, anything else that's exciting to you, that anything you want to pitch, not pitch, anything you want to promote?
Well, just right now, I'm directing the current show at the Groundlings. It's called Chet Groundlings. And it's fun. It's like sketches and improv. And then I start teaching at the American Film Institute. I teach improv to directors. I'm doing a lot of voiceover, so that's always good. That's always fun for me. You know, Phil does a lot, and so does Gary and Cedric. Yeah. It actually, that's another thing, too, like voice acting. It does require you to have a strong like sense of character, and you know, it's really fun. Plus you don't have to wear any makeup.
I'm kind of imagining you all doing something where it's just like a video of something that, you know, that you're improvising. I think it'd be amazing if some animation that it's already exists that you would all improvise.
We were doing these podcasts that were just amazing. And everyone was doing characters, and we did spoofs of like judge shows. We did spoofs of morning shows, and they were all recorded as podcasts. We even tried to make it something that was live film. But the thing is, when you get too many people telling you what to do, that's when the brand gets kind of, you know, it just got, it kind of went south. But in its inception, it was a really great idea. Years ago, I worked with the Mark Taper Forum, which is a theater in Los Angeles. And we would do these workshop symposiums, and we'd go to inner city schools and do these communication workshops. And these kids who are really shut down, or either they're from El Salvador where they've lost their parents and they need some way, an outlet to communicate, improv was their way. And it's,
yeah,
oh my God, it's rewarding, but it's sad, but it's challenging, but it's uplifting at the same time. It's a lot.
I'm just curious on what your experiences in being Japanese, or as a minority or a double minority as a female, how does that affect how you work with a mostly black cast? And if
it doesn't, I've known Jordan for so long, and we're just friends, right? We didn't seek it out at the beginning either, like that. It just kind of worked out that way. He's like, oh man, this is even better. You're a person of color, I'm a person of color. You know what I mean?
Everyone who's talked to me about it is just like, oh, it's nothing to do with race. I'm like, I get it.
It isn't. Although it kind of is, right? In other words, we're not going to do black movies. We don't do the black Black movie. You know what I mean? They're just always kind of those mainstream films. And when we say iconic, most of them are, but some of them are really stupid. Like we did the Black version of Point Break, just because I thought that was so funny, you know? And so they weren't surfers, they were paddleboarders, and they were, you know, whatever it was. So it really doesn't, for me, it's like I always fight against it, like especially like in my acting career. When I first started, always was, you know, it had to be ethnic or it had to be this, right? But I was born here. So then I had to work on my accents and my dialects, and I had to kind of be able to pass, you know? So it's kind of nice to just like kind of do a mashup. I think I don't know how interesting it looks or people even think about that, but you got an all Black improv group with an Asian director, you know? I don't think it's a problem. I don't think it was something that was done deliberately. I do think that our experiences and improv just kind of brought us together by happen.
I'll give you one last question to call it a day. Are there three movies that you have never done that are like on your list of like, I hope they pick these. Is there anything, any one or two movies or even one that you would like, oh, we need to do this one day.
You know what? In 13 years, we've done most of them. You know what I mean? But, you know, for me, there are certain musicals I wouldn't mind doing, you know, like My Fair Lady or something like that, the Black version of My Fair Lady, or the Black version of Yentl, or things, those are my guilty pleasures at the night that make me laugh, you know. Predator, I would just, you know, there, if I'm going for that, you know, but we don't guide the audience in terms of what they shout out. And a lot of times, they shout out the same thing. So every once in a while, when they shout out something weird, I'm going to go for it, you know? So,
yeah. Well, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for your time and patience. All right. Well, you have a great day. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Have a good one.
You too. Thank you so much.